We are continuing to talk about the perfection of wisdom. And we talked last week a bit about the Heart Sutra. For a couple months, we've been looking at bits of idea from the great primary text in this tradition, known as the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines. It's not as intimidating as it sounds. It actually is as intimidating as it sounds, so that's why I'm reading it for you, and we're talking about little bits. But I encourage you to get it and read it. Very, very unfortunately, the translation hasn't been updated since the kind of original English translation by Edward Conzi. And I was reading it. I'm reading in chapter 12 right now. I'm going to talk to you about the very first little section of chapter 12. But there's a little footnote, a page into chapter 12, that literally says, "The following disquisition is quite unintelligible as it stands. I have therefore freely interpolated the comments of Hari Bhadra's commentary." So, you know, like Kanzi is saying, like, I don't even get this. I have no idea what they're saying. So, you know, I brought in some of the commentary. So there you go. I don't think it's quite as unintelligible as he says it is, but it is kind of like a passage that we read a couple weeks ago. It is a bit of slam poetry in a certain way. But the piece I want to pull out tonight is this bit that we hinted at in the meditation and talked about a little bit last week around the figure of Prajnaparamita as a goddess. And so once again, the basic logic that's spelled out in the text goes something like this, right? A little bit like we reflected on in the meditation. Because the fruit of practice, the thing that makes one a realized being, a Buddha or an Arahant or a Bodhisattva, the quality that leads to that fruit is wisdom, is insight leading to wisdom. So whenever you've been practicing or you've been influenced by these teachings and you have a moment, either a flash of insight kind of moment or a developing change in the course of your life where bit by bit you mature into a kind of understanding or knowing of the world, your life, how things are, that was different than before, and it's liberating, right? You see something clearer. That fruit of practice comes because of wisdom. It comes because of many qualities having been cultivated. You've been cultivating generosity or letting go or, you know, kindness and compassion. But the insight quality itself is the wisdom quality. And the idea is that it's particularly the wisdom quality that leads to freedom through the unbinding of suffering, right? So going all the way back to the basic formulation that there is pain, dukkha, first noble truth, and there's a cause for that dukkha, tanha, thirst, second noble truth. So craving gives rise to suffering. Right, that when you see clearly something, that craving can be uprooted. When the craving gets uprooted, the suffering stops, and the end of suffering is liberating. How do you uproot craving? You see something clearly, and that clear seeing, one of the paradigmatic things you see is, for instance, change, right? You see impermanence. You might say, oh, this thing that my heart is contracted around, this thing I really want, it's not ultimately satisfying because I can't keep it, You know, it's here for a flash and then it's gone. You know. Now we're not always permeable to that logic, right? Ask anyone who has like a mad crush and just tell them like, "Oh yeah, this crush you have, you know it's impermanent. Like your feelings will change, that person will change." Even if, you know, even if you get the perfect end to the rom-com, like a long happy life together, you know, I got the relationship, boom 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 boom, you know, eventually one of you dies and the other one of you is holding them, you know, like the mark of impermanence and the insight into that suggests that there's something that we need to know about reality that we're just not willing to know in a certain way, or we can't see yet, but that when we see it, a certain kind of contraction in the heart will end. Say, oh, I can see that. And so I'm not, you know, it's not that I don't love, but maybe I don't, fall into deluded narratives, you know. It's not even that I don't grasp, perhaps, maybe in a healthy way, maybe in a wild, you know, passionate way momentarily, and I'm willing to suffer because love is so great. But what if I could do that in a way where I'm not deluded about impermanence, right? That there would be that the suffering might not be the same. Maybe it would even be a kind of transfigured sort of love if that suffering wasn't there. This is the core thesis that the Buddha brings forward. So when you see impermanence, right, and that kind of letting go matures in you, that's the work of wisdom. And so wisdom gives birth to that freedom, right? The quality of wisdom arising in you or touching you gives birth to that freedom. What makes an ordinary suffering being a Buddha? Right? The Buddha wasn't a Buddha when he was born. He was this kid, Gotama, of the Sakyan clan. And, you know, he was not liberated when he was born. He had to find his way, right? He had all sorts of confusions. He practiced in unskillful ways. He practiced in skillful ways. He had big questions. He found his way. And he found his way through wisdom. Right? He found the practices that made it possible for wisdom to arise. He did those practices very fully and directed his heart toward understanding. And that understanding appeared. And so what makes humans a Buddha is wisdom. Buddhas are born from wisdom. Therefore, wisdom is a mother. Right? That's the logic. So this is the logic laid out in the Perfection of Wisdom texts. Wisdom is like a maternal figure because wisdom gives birth to Buddhas. So wisdom is the mother of all Buddhas. So this is then the one of the names of Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is the mother of all the Buddhas. And she gets portrayed then as this this goddess figure. And her goddess posture is that she's always in deep meditation, so that's like full lotus, meditation hands, different from, you know, Kuan Yin, who is often standing, or Tara, who sits with one leg coming off the meditative seat. Some of the pictures of Kuan Yin with one leg coming off the meditative seat. Prajnaparamita, wisdom, is really in deep contemplation. So the Mahayana tradition takes this extension of the basic teachings that wisdom gives rise to freedom, takes it into what will become a devotional posture, right? Because once there's a goddess figure, how do you practice with that? Well, you bow down, you know, you say her name, you do the mantra, you make the heart into the kind of shape that can, you know, receive her blessing, the blessing of wisdom. But you can do this in a devotional way, right? And so then the shift in a certain way from the early meditative tradition, the insight tradition, right? How we started in the meditation, like get as steady as you can, and then look with the eye of insight at changing phenomena. This is like, you know, basic or pure vipassana. Look at changing phenomena and notice that they're changing. So you're aware of what's called the mark of impermanence. Lakana is mark in Pali. So the mark of impermanence, anicca. This is why when Goenka gives his instructions on scanning the body and observing that the micro sensations in the body are constantly changing, he says it like it's a mental label. Anicca, anicca, again and again, anicca. Because what you can see is you say, oh, it's changing. It's changing. And you get this, almost this pulse of recognition, right? And this leads to, in Vipassana, this leads to a state that's it's the fourth of the stage, 16 stages of insight, if you're tracking that kind of thing. And it's the stage known as arising and passing. And it's, in a certain way, the most important of the early states in that sequence. What it looks like, how it's described, and kind of how it feels, is that you can see means like become aware of, it's not visual, but like you can sense the every moment newness of phenomena. Sensory phenomena, so seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and cognitive phenomena, feelings and thoughts, you can sense that in every moment, they're a little different. It's always changing, right? The image is changing, the sounds are changing, sensations and thoughts are changing, mood is changing. And if you get really steady in perceiving this, you start to have this kind of flickering perception arise. It feels a little bit like a strobe light. One teacher calls it like a ratchety sort of feeling. One of the trippiest ways to feel it is in movement. The first time I felt it in movement really strongly, I was in Burma, I was doing long retreat. And this is the kind of retreat designed to induce this experience. And you're moving in slow motion. I was doing Mahasi style practice. You're moving in slow motion all day, noting every couple seconds what's happening. And it's just tuning your attention to change, 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 change. And I'd been doing this for a couple of months. And it was a hot afternoon. And I kind of felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. This is always when things happen. I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. So I went back to my little room and I laid down under the mosquito net to take a nap. And as I was laying down, I reached up my arm, still moving in slow motion, because I was immersed in slow motion at the time, to adjust something up near my head. And it felt like my arm was moving, and just by itself, it was like it was going kung, 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 like that, like the old Bionic Man sound, for those of you who are old enough to have watched the Bionic Man in the 1970s. I was lucid enough at the time to be like, oh, that's what they're talking about, you know. And then I just went like noting, you know, ratcheting, you know. What you're seeing is that nothing is continuous. Even a continuous movement of your limb is actually composed of a whole lot of little moments called move. Okay, I moved. Now move again, or continue moving. So there's little bursts of intention and action. And you can perceive them when the mind gets really quiet and slow. And they kind of go do 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 do. So a different time I was at Spirit Rock on long retreat, and I was out walking, and it was happening not in movement, but more like in sight and sound. And it was literally like I was kind of, for a few moments, in a sort of rave where everything was like, the sights and sounds were just going like, all over the place. I was like, oh yeah, that thing. So this is arising and passing. And the insight that's supposed to come of this is that because everything is changing so fast, there's nothing to hold on to, right? And the meditation instruction when that starts happening is just to let go and let it happen, right? To stay really quiet, just kind of let it flow. And it kind of unfolds on its own from there. So this is the kind of the early Buddhist form of this, or the Vipassana form of this, is to see impermanence. The Mahayana, right, makes that interpretive leap to wisdom being a goddess. They essentially do a kind of meta-reflection on it. Meta, one T, not two. A little meta-reflection, like, oh, what does this mean that wisdom gives rise to freedom? And they realize that wisdom has this birth-giving quality. And I think there's a beautiful sort of metaphoric or almost like emotional, affective shift in here, where wisdom becomes not this like cool, crisp, clear-seeing quality, but this very warm, nurturing quality. And I think it comes from recognizing that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, enlightened beings, they are still humans, but they're a very different kind of human. It's almost like they're recognizing that like regular, you know, unenlightened humans like us, we are a certain kind of matter, a certain kind of entity, but that when Buddhas are born, they're kind of wildly different from the people around them. And in a certain way, they've been born as a different thing. And lots of religions think about the conversion into profound connection with the divine as a kind of second birth, right? As a kind of rebirth, or being born again, right? And so Buddhas are born. Right, it's not just a gradual arc into like, oh yeah, my teacher's pretty wise. I hope they are, but like Buddhas are something else entirely. So they're born. So here's a bit of how chapter 12. This is the beginning of chapter 12 of the Prajnaparamita. Says this. This is the Buddha speaking. It is as with a mother who has many children. 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or 100 or 1,000. If she fell ill, they would all exert themselves to prevent their mother from dying, to keep her alive as long as possible, to keep pain and unpleasantness away from her body, because they are aware that to her they owe their existence, that in great pain she has brought them into the world, that she has instructed them in the ways of the world. They would therefore look well after her, give her everything they can to make her happy, protect her well, make much of her, and they will hope that she be free from pain, etc., etc., etc. In this way, those children honor their mother by giving her all they can to make her happy. In just this same way, the Tathagatas, which is the Buddhas, the enlightened ones, bring this perfection of wisdom to mind, and it is through their might, sustaining power and grace, that people write, learn, study, spread, and repeat it. And also the Tathagatas, the enlightened ones, who dwell in other world systems just now, for the weal and happiness of the many, out of pity for the many, for the weal and happiness of a great body of people. From compassion for gods, men, and all beings, they also bring this perfection of wisdom to mind, and they put forth zeal so that this perfection of wisdom may last long, so that it may not be destroyed. So that Mara and his host may not prevent this perfection of wisdom from being taught, written, and practiced. So fond are the Tathagatas of this perfection of wisdom, so much do they cherish and protect it. For she is their mother and begetter. She showed them this all knowledge. She instructed them in the ways of the world. From her have the Tathagatas come forth. For she has begotten and shown that cognition of the all-knowing. She has shown them the world for what it really is. The all-knowledge of the Tathagatas has come forth from her. All the Tathagatas, past, future, and present, win full enlightenment thanks to this very perfection of wisdom. It is in this sense that the perfection of wisdom generates the Tathagatas and instructs them in the world. All right, so there's very explicitly this parallel being made. The Tathagatas, that's literally, that means the ones thus gone. That's the word the Buddha would use for himself. He'd say the Tathagata, the one thus gone. The Tathagatas are brought forth in the world by the perfection of wisdom. And the quality here, right, is gratitude. Right? Gratitude for how much our mothers have done for us, for the pain they went through giving birth to us, and particularly for their instruction of us in the ways of the world. It's important to say here that not everyone's actual human mother is an easy object of gratitude. We all have things to work out with our mothers. Some of our mothers instructed us well in the ways of the world, some perhaps not so well. And we can have all sorts of feelings around this idea that it should be obvious that one would honor one's mother in this profound way, and that therefore one would know how to honor the mother of the Buddhas in this way. I think there's a deep grief that we may touch into when we connect with even the idea, this kind of an archetypally good mother that this text starts off with, right? That it suggests that, you know, this is what a mother is, that out of this extraordinary generosity and giving quality, she brings forth us into the world and instructs us in all of these ways. There's all these different places in the texts where this is the assumed relationship, not necessarily assumed like you're wrong if you don't have it, but it's the ideal relationship that children have with their parents, which is one of gratitude for all of that our parents have given us. And it's a challenging practice to take it on. And I know folks who have specifically taken on this practice as a kind of healing ritual, you know, kind of a purification ritual for our real human family systems, to, maybe to put, you know, to put an image of our parents. The gratitude practice, you know, applies for both parents, if we have them, or whether we know them or not, both parents that gave birth to us and raised us, if those are the same people. For me, they're different people, so I've got both birth parents and adoptive parents in that position to thank in different ways. One who gave birth to me, one who raised me, two who raised me. It can be a beautiful purification practice to even, you know, a little bit like in metta practice, loving kindness practice, the way that we sometimes turn toward a difficult person. There was a while in loving kindness practice where my mother was my difficult person. I was trying to figure out something about being grateful for her and heal in my own heart some of that relationship that had been quite difficult, honestly. I think what I would encourage here is not that we, you know, feel any kind of shame or wrongness if our relationship with our parents is fraught, but also that we don't give up on it internally. I don't know whether that means we need to be in contact with them if we're not, you know, like there's lots of different reasons why we could take any number of relational stances in relation to our real human parents. But in the heart, to practice with how could I find this core quality of gratitude? What would I have to feel or work through, be present with in order to find some aspect of that? That's sort of the first half of the metaphor, right? The way that the way that you might feel about your real human mother, where there's this kind of gratitude, then you might know something about how to be grateful for wisdom. Because the teaching here for the perfection of wisdom is that you would know somehow how to be grateful for gifts given to you. If it's difficult to be grateful for gifts given to us by a parent, you might start, again, like we do in loving kindness practice, with an easier source of gift for yourself, like a benefactor or a teacher or a mentor or an elder or a good friend. And then the meditation can become, how can I turn that kind of gratitude toward, I would say, like toward the path itself? Because the if I'm devoted toward prajna paramita as the perfection of wisdom, what I'm really saying, I think, is that I'm in touch with gratitude for the path and for the fruits of practice. Because what is wisdom but the pinnacle of the path, or the fruit of all practice? And so to be grateful for wisdom and everything that she has given us is to be grateful for the Dhamma, for the path, and everything that has given us. So I think really this devotion to the mother of all the Buddhas is a kind of devotion to the second jewel, right? The jewel of the Dhamma, or the Dharma, in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. When the Buddha discovers the path by himself after leaving his teachers because their teachings only took him part way, and leaving his ascetic friends because their practice only took him part way, when he discovers the path in the form of the insights of seeing his past lives, seeing the workings of karma in rebirth, and uprooting the defilements, seeing how the Four Noble Truths works, seeing how dependent origination works, he reports being so grateful and astonished at finding this path that he describes it to finding an overgrown path in the jungle, as if you're in a stretch of woods, you're off trail, right? He had gone off trail, right? The thing your teachers are telling you to do, that's the trail. He went off trail because he could tell that the trail didn't lead where he needed it to go. So he's bushwhacking. And he says he finds a trail that is almost entirely overgrown. All right, and so this is interesting because it's not, he wouldn't have called it a trail if it was completely overgrown. It's not raw forest. People have passed this way before, beings of various kinds. So the trail is faint, but he finds it. And following it means he clears it with his own effort, with the machete of the mind and heart, with jhana, with determination, with inquiry. And he says that what he comes upon is like finding an ancient city deep in the forest. And the city is abandoned and overgrown, but you can tell it's there. You know, the buildings are there. And it's glorious. It's like a palace. You know, it's an enormous, beautiful place. So he finds something that has been there before him, that's always available. It's the finding of the Dhamma when the trail has been lost that makes someone a Buddha. Because once he clears the trail and makes it walkable and leads other people along that trail to the city of freedom, those people are not Buddhas, right? They're arhants, perfected ones. The students of Buddhas aren't Buddhas, because one of the defining qualities of being a Buddha is that you find it by yourself. And so Buddha doesn't mean somebody that's, the Buddha isn't more awakened than the arhants. The Buddha says very categorically, the liberation of the arhants and the liberation of himself are the same. Liberation from suffering is liberation from suffering. Doesn't matter how you got there. But the thing that makes one a Buddha is that you found it by yourself, And it seems to be, this develops in the Mahayana, that one of the implications of that is that you're really good at teaching. Not all the arhats are good at teaching. Buddhas have this extraordinary skill in teaching. And I think that we can, in a way, understand this as being connected to having had to find the path for themselves. He tried a lot of things before he found that path. And the thing that he found came with a profound understanding of how other beings' minds work, right? He becomes clairvoyant. He can see where people pass on in accordance with their actions. He can predict or describe people's rebirths. Not predict, but he can describe people's rebirths. Sometimes he predicts. He's careful to say that he doesn't know the future, but you know, it looks likely that this person is gonna, you know, go to here or there based on their actions. So he finds this Dhamma, this teaching, and that's the thing that he's in devotion to. So to be grateful for the fruit of practice in the form of wisdom, in the form of insight, and in the you know, mythic form of an extraordinary maternal figure, a mother of all the Buddhas. I think this is a way of personifying this Dharma that has given us so much, that has shown us how to be in the world, and that to whatever extent we are awakened, partly or more than partly, it's this great, great mother that has given birth to that liberated one that is ourselves. And so then you can praise her, you can want her to be healthy, you can want to take care of her. And this is the last point in this, that the text, and for those of you who've been reading this with me for a couple months, we've been talking about this, really, this is a text tradition, this is a literature. And what the literature wants in this kind of poignant way is to survive. And so the text says again and again that the way you worship this teaching is by copying it down, by memorizing a verse, by teaching it to others, right? By making a copy and giving it to others. This is how you venerate the mother that you want to protect from sickness and loss, is you give her what she needs to thrive. And if that mother is the perfection of wisdom, then what you do is you ensure that she survives by copying out the text. Nowadays, you could just, you know, I can send you a PDF. This is very good. It's much easier than it used to be. But what we are doing right now actually is feeding her, right? This text says, this is the devotional practice. It's not that you have to do something different, like sing her name 108,000 times or do prostrations. You can do that. It's marvelous. But this is actually the thing, because she's wisdom, right? Wisdom is her body. And so what we're doing right now, actually, in discussing her, is keeping her alive, is feeding her, keeping her safe from harm, right? So maybe I'll finish talking here about it, and I want to hear some other words from y'all. But take a moment and see if you can make this turn in the heart, where you understand that what we're doing here is not just hearing somebody give a talk on the perfection of wisdom, which is fine. It's a good place to start. But that what we are doing, actually, in a world of deep change and loss, is that we are keeping the perfection of wisdom alive. And in keeping the perfection of wisdom alive, we are honoring the mother of our freedom, the mother of whatever gifts the Dhamma has given us. And this is already that. This is that honoring. Take a moment and see just what comes if you turn the heart toward that knowing. Part of what happens for me, I'll say, and then I want to hear from some of y'all. part of what happens for me is that I can remember a time in my practice life when I wasn't really engaged with these teachings, when I was engaged in other teachings that were lovely. And I can feel what it's like right now to have, for a season now or so, to have retaken them up. I've had phases. Those of you that have been with me for many years know that I've had phases of coming in and out of this body of teachings. We did a whole thing on the Diamond Sutra like 6 years ago. I love these teachings and I come back to them again and again. Coming back to them this summer, I can feel how something about them is now present in my life in a way that was more quiet before, right? And I've never actually taught on this exact text, right? Repeated and copied and, you know, spoken these verses to you. And so just in a very straightforward way, in my own life, there's a kind of aliveness of this particular mother. There's a presence of this, there's a kind of force that these teachings have, and they're present with me. They're nearby. She's nearby because we're doing this. And I can just feel that. It feels different than when I'm further away from this text. Yeah? So I'm going to pause there and continue to take a moment and just see what you notice about that, and then we'll share a little bit together. Anything you notice there.